that there. Great. So my name is Jordy Izzard, and I'm an alumni relations officer at SAIS, and I am here with Charles Rose, who graduated in the class of 1957. And today's date is April 7th, 2011, and I'm so glad you're here with us today.
Thank you.
So the first question that we were talking about that I have is just what brought you to SAIS originally?
I thought I wanted to go into the State Department, for which I more or less was entirely unsuited, so I never went.
So that's what you originally thought. Now,
yeah.
How did you have an interest in that? Even
I was interested in history.
Okay. And did you major in that as an undergrad? Or?
I did at Hamilton College.
Okay. And so you came to SAIS, and then what are your memories of being at SAIS?
Well, in those days, SAIS was in a very rundown building on Florida Avenue, which was a so-so neighborhood. I remember the back alley was swarming with rats, the largest I've ever seen in my life. The faculty, I thought, looking back on it, was, I hate to say this, but rather indifferent. They had all done something else, and their view of history, I thought, was extremely parochial. But that's in hindsight, because I didn't know anything when I was there. It was interesting. I got a little training in language.
What language?
French, which I did learn to speak and write, but not at SAIS. And the best tutoring I had was with Madame Charbonneau, whose daughter, I think, had a career in journalism in Washington, D.C., but I may be wrong about that. But she was the daughter of a man called Henri de Carrelis, who was a journalist and on the and a very sharp journalist. She was very interesting. We had a lot of nice conversations. The one professor that I had at SAIS, who I thought was extremely sophisticated, was Mario Toscano, who was in the Ministri degli Esteri and was a person who constantly said, tutti hanno ragione, tutti hanno torto. That's not my interpretation of things today. But I didn't know enough how, I couldn't really approach him. I found the most interesting thing about attending SAIS with my fellow students. Some of them had excellent careers in the Foreign Service and were sharp then and are still sharp, I think. I particularly remember David Korn, who had an interesting career, but who is now retired and has written a couple of books, one on Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
We had a lot of fun. I was kind of wild, dancing around, not knowing what I wanted to do, really, and just wasting time. I thought the training in economics was not particularly interesting. There was no philosophical underpinning to the presentation of historical materials, which is a mistake. It was only later on that I began to read in that area when I came to Columbia and worked on my PhD, which I did receive in history. And for a number of years I taught. But I think this, all in all, because experience is such a curious thing, SAIS was a very worthwhile experience. Because it gave me a lot of time to read, which I always did, and mature. I remember particularly the librarian there, Frank Shork, I believe, who was an interesting fellow and took me out to his country place, which he rented with some of my friends, and we had a very good time with him. He's a nice man. And I remember, of course, Dean Thayer, who was extremely tolerant of all my vagaries. And I remember him fondly.
That's great.
Some of the interests that I later developed started at SAIS, particularly my interest in Roman law. And that was because I studied international law there. And but as I said, those courses were really, I don't want to say superficial, but they were for beginners who knew nothing about the international law. And I mm-hmm. think that's maybe the way it should have been. Mm-hmm. You really learn on the job once you start working. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when I really started to learn is when I started to teach, mm-hmm. which was during my PhD period at Columbia.
All along, while you were at SICE, you still thought you were going to do State Department?
I did.
Or did that shift midway?
No. I was interested in other things. I really wasn't interested in the nitty-gritty of, and I'd have been terrible at it. Just wouldn't have interested me at all.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what
I wouldn't have been married. I wouldn't have minded being a 19th century ambassador at the Sublime Port, but I wouldn't have done very well in Ouagadougou.
So tell us a little bit about what your career, or how did it evolve once you left SICE, and you mentioned getting a PhD.
I taught. I almost got tenure at one point at NYU. I was down at NYU, mm-hmm. and I gave a lecture, which was kind of interesting, and I got a very good offer, but unfortunately, about 4 weeks later, the man who made the offer died. So... in a place like that, once you lose your patron, you've lost. And the university itself began to take a different turn. I finally went into fundraising, which is what I'm doing now, and still doing. And I think there I learned how to write at SICE. And that's what I do for a living now. I still write. So I'm very fortunate in a way. Although I didn't have a very brilliant career, it's a long career. And I'm still able to work, which people my age usually aren't. Mm-hmm. So
that's wonderful. So you went to SICE, and then you went straight to Columbia to do your PhD?
I did, exactly okay. that. I sat for the, I took the written examination. I passed the written examination for the State Department. And then when I just sat down and thought about it, and I said, no, this isn't for me. Mm-hmm. So I didn't go further.
Mm-hmm. And then once you left Columbia, you taught at NYU right after that?
Where did I start teaching? I started teaching in a place called Queens College because my one of my professors was teaching there, and I taught there. In those days, I had excellent students there, and then I used the great books that not the great books. What is it called? Contemporary Civilization course, which was identical to the basic course given at Columbia, and. That was wonderful for me because I had to lecture on all of these various subjects. But unfortunately, and then I, what did I do? Oh, it's complicated to think back now. I went from there to suddenly the atmosphere at that school, which was essentially dependent on people coming in from the high schools in the area changed, and it changed because the policy changed. Now anyone, you to get in there, you really had to have a B+ average, mm-hmm. and that meant that the students, they all had second languages, they were all pretty skilled and could write English. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Suddenly that changed with, I think, a very foolish policy of thinking that everyone should go to college. Because when everyone goes to college, no one goes. And I had classes where people couldn't read or write. And that was a real revelation to me because it revealed the chaotic state of the New York public schools, which couldn't handle the kind of students they suddenly had. Mm-hmm. And so what did I do then?
How long were you there?
I was there off and on for about 3 or 4 years, 5 years. Mm-hmm. Then and I was still working on my PhD at that time. Mm-hmm. Then what did I do? Then I went.
Did you get?
Yes, I began at that point. I went to Teachers College, and a rather interesting man, William Summerscales, who was the head of the development office, said, well, you can come here as a volunteer and learn something, which is what I did. I volunteered, and then I got my first job about a year later at a school which was going under, Finch College, and it has since closed its doors. I didn't know anything about development, even at that point, but I began to learn. And then I went to a place called the New York Studio School, which was an absolutely fascinating school with wonderful, wonderful artists who were also teachers, and no tuition, so it depended on raising money completely. It was headed by Mercedes Matter, who in her own right was a competent artist and was the daughter of Arthur B. Carles, a very talented and gifted painter who bought the great Cezannes, which are now in the collection of the Philadelphia Museum. He was extremely eclectic, Carles, in his style as a painter. He'd go to Paris, see something new, and come back and paint that way. So he ran his work, he never found his own style. But Mercedes certainly did. She knew all of the major artists, and many of them had taught at the studio school, and or their wives taught there. So it had a wonderful faculty. Andrew Forge, who became the head of the School of Art at Yale, was there as well. So I learned a great deal. I met all sorts of people I'd never had a chance to meet. I learned a great deal about art. And I started at that point. I went over and got a part-time job teaching at NYU and taught there for a while. NYU was in a great turmoil.
Can I ask, I'm just curious, what history you taught?
I taught an enormous variety. Joanne, excuse me.
That's okay.
You're going to have to sit by the phone there, Joanne.
Sorry.
A phone that works.
It's fine. Yeah. So you taught...
I'm sorry, we can go
no,
back.
No worries. So we're talking about, you learned a lot about art, and the people there were fascinating. And then that brought you to
Barnett Newman, for instance, taught there, Napkin. I don't know if you know any of these names, but all of the major figures of the New York School. And Mercedes had worked with Lachaise on some of the murals that replaced Thomas... who was it? Not Thomas Hart Benton. Thomas Hart... he's an American painter, Mexican painter, Rivera. Rivera was at did some painting for Rockefeller, and that caused a tremendous uproar. And his paintings, of which showed Rockefeller and all sorts of people as right-wing bastards. What else can you say? So the Rockefeller family became absolutely enraged. They destroyed the painting to such a degree that it could never be resuscitated. They gouged it out, more or less, having paid Rivera $23,000 or $25,000 for his work. It was really a tremendous act of vandalism. And very short-sighted.
And then you went and you taught it. You started in a part-time position at NYU?
Yes, I started it in their general studies and lectured there and did development work for the New York Studio School at the same time. And by that time, I'd done enough reading, so I had a completely different view of history. And what did I do then? I just... I began to use that in I was invited to give some lectures, and one of the deans heard the lecture and thought it was quite wonderful, and so he made an offer to me.
That's great.
But then he died, unfortunately.
Wow,
but all that, you know, strangely enough, how life is, you get very disappointed at the time, but...
then it evolves into other things.
That's right.
Yeah.
And
how did that evolve for you from there?
It evolved for me because then I had to earn a living. So I left the New York Studio School and started doing development work at a school right next door, St. Hilda's and St. Hugh's School. I taught there, and I did their development work. I really founded their development department and got their first major grants. And those are the first large grants I got. And then I went on to other places. Because the more, you know, you bounce around with development, eventually you learn how to do it. And I went from place to place until finally I wound up vice president at this ancient but not terribly successful social service agency. It was very successful because it endured and has since 1846 and does a wonderful job and always has. And it all the skills I developed suddenly came together, and I was able to raise a lot of money for them, the first major grants, which they desperately needed and still need. And then I retired, and then they called me back because their development office, they couldn't get a decent development officer who could raise any money for them. So I came back, put the development office back together again. And now I, and all of the writing projects I have, I still do a lot of writing for them.
You enjoy that?
I do that, and it's so, it's easy for me to do. And it's very, I do their annual report, their newsletters, their, all their proposal writing. I start new projects because that was advice I got from one of the foundation. You just can't ask for money. You really have to start things. You have to create the projects themselves. And since education is what I'm interested in, I got the idea that the foster children really were, since they had no homes, essentially, and their parents were usually right at the bottom of the American barrel, they needed the agency to step in locus parentis, which is what's happened. And we provide scholarships for them. I raise some money for that. When I came, none of them were going to college. Now we have college graduates. We have a doctor who's just become a young woman without parents who was really on the, literally on the sidewalk.
Wow.
I remember the first time I met her, she didn't even have a warm coat in the middle of New York winter.
Wow.
Everything is a chance for foster children. It's very, very interesting. And the city has never, ever developed a real policy that is consistent and protective. It tries, but it doesn't work terribly well. So terrible scandals occur all the time. But you probably don't want me to go into that. It's sort of...
No, that's fine. So you've had a really interesting career.
It's been interesting to me.
I mean,
and it's
you
still
started,
going on.
Yeah, thinking that...
I just started a project.
Go into... Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
I just started a project to provide tutor mentoring to children who are in our neighborhood. And I got three foundations, actually, to support it.
That's wonderful.
I raised about $130,000, which isn't a lot of money today, but it gave it its first year. We finally found someone who could run it properly, and now it's taken off, and it's just doing wonderful stuff.
That's great.
The thing about the social situation in the United States is that it's not large projects, but small, targeted projects which really reach individuals, that is the only way to move society forward. It's not the collective that's so important, it's the individual that's important. And if I had ever learned anything in life, it's that. Look around, because the brightest people need the most help if they're stuck in a society that doesn't stimulate them, in terrible schools, which is often what exists. But you take that same child, give it, it's like a plant, start feeding it, and everything changes for that child. And you get wonderful results. And you can also pull the others up so they can get a high school degree, become a nurse, become a dental assistant, come on, hairdresser, get off the street and make the first steps into the middle class. And that's what really interests me today. Developing projects which really could be replicated, but I don't think they ever will. And it's all a matter of leadership within the institution, leadership within the projects that the institution is sponsoring.
Mm-hmm. So you've had an interesting life. I mean, you started out thinking you were going in the State Department, and that turned into a degree in history, a PhD, and you taught for a long time, and then the experience that you had with a professor dying really sort of pushed you into needing to earn some money, and
sure.
getting into the field of development yeah. seemed of interest to you, and look where it's brought you. You're still doing projects today.
Yeah, I'm still doing projects today.
That's wonderful. And what advice, then, would you have for current students at SAIS, given your sort of starting point and where you've ended up?
I don't think advice is worth anything. I think what has to happen is that people have to learn from experience. Advice is not only cheap, but it's mostly useless. It might be very good advice, by the way. It's not that. It's that you really can't do anything with it because temperamentally you're not suited to that advice.
Right.
It's interesting. I think I probably work with greater concentration now at 79 than I did when I was a young person mm-hmm. rattling around. Mm-hmm. I'm much more focused.
That's great. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I enjoyed SAIS, and mm-hmm. I think it probably today offers a great deal to anyone who can benefit from it. It's just that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your time. That's those are all the questions I have, and I really appreciate it.
One thing I didn't
yes.
mention, by
yes.
the way, which I should, is the Bologna Center, which
yes.
I attended in its second year, I think.
Uh-huh.
That was a wonderful experience for me.
Great. Tell me about that.
Well, I met all sorts of people. And I lived not in the dormitories, which probably was a mistake, but in the Periferia, which is the large suburban area, and in those days was right on the edge of a farming community. And I used to walk out, and one of my favorite walks was to go to the local church, which is in a completely rural community, and observe the people in the church. The priest would arrive on a motorcycle, sometimes someone else's motorcycle mm-hmm. sitting behind. He would perform mass, the whole peasant community, really, because that's what they were. They mm-hmm. crowded in. They kept a tremendous racket going until the moment of the elevation, when suddenly a hush fell for a second or two, and then the mass was almost at an end, and they were talking vigorously. So it was what the church had always been, it seemed to me. I began to understand the role of the church in the Middle Ages as the social center of every peasant community, and that was when I started reading people like mm-hmm. you know, Mark Bloch and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. I began to understand what they were trying to say mm-hmm. because of that experience. And the other thing I learned was there was a house on the Periferia which had a dog house behind it, which was a model of the little villa. It was a suburban 18th century suburban villa. And the people in the neighborhood called it the Casa del Cane Lupo. And they talked about the countess turning into a wolf at night. It was the myth of the lycanthrope that had survived in that area. And that began interesting me in myth and the mythic underpinning of religion. I read a lot of stuff, all the stuff people read, from Gilbert Murray to Jane Harrison and so on and so forth. And then I began to read the Bible in the light of that, and began to see deep into the past, which is the most interesting thing in historical documents. They're really like onions, work mm-hmm. like the Bible, in many, many layers, until you get right back to the most primitive beliefs buried deep within the texts. Mm-hmm. Most interpretation of things is extremely superficial. people only see the surfaces. When I look at American policy, that's what I see, people without any real knowledge and depth of the past. They're looking at everything like that, and they don't see very much. It all comes as a terrible surprise. Whereas if they had a more profound knowledge of the past, a deeper knowledge of it in time and in evolution, they'd have a better understanding of the mentalities they were dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, great. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it, and I'm glad to know some of your stories.
Thanks so much for coming.
And have a wonderful day.
You too.